We're recording, having spent the first 20 minutes of the class talking about Frankie. All right. We've been talking about job analysis, and we've gotten to the point where we got the major and minor responsibilities, sort of spelled out what they were, and we need to finish this up with a few more considerations. The job analysis, as I mentioned to you before, is the crucial document by which you're going to do tons of different stuff. You're going to create performance appraisals, create pay systems, create selection processes, and of course training processes, etc. You're certainly not going to hire somebody in your selection process without understanding what the job is that you're hiring for, etc. So what we're looking at here then is a key document. So let me finish this up. I can go over right what I wrote on the last one right there. So let's pretend multiple pages here. Pretty good rendition of multiple pages, if I have to say myself. And let's say what the job analysis is going to look like as we put this together. Now, I talked to you about the major and minor responsibilities, and they're going to fall down this way. We'll talk to you about them in a minute. But up here, you're going to have the job number or the job name or some definition of which job we're talking about. Apropos of this particular point here, the job number often corresponds with the Department of Labor number, so that when you see a number, you could go right to the Dictionary of Occupational Titles that I mentioned to you and see what it says there about a job, too. So it just depends on how companies want to do it. Sometimes they use their own numbers, sometimes they use the Department of Labor numbers. And at the top, we'll have various pieces of information that might be useful. The date that it was done, for example, the supervisor of the job at the time, whether or not it's an exempt or non-exempt. Do you know what that means, exempt versus non-exempt?
Whether or not you get overtime.
Exactly, out of the Fair Labor Standards Act, 1935. So what we're looking at here is whether or not you're exempt from the requirement, whether that job is exempt from the requirement of overtime. Managers, traveling salespeople, long-haul truck drivers, et cetera, quite often are exempt. They don't get time and a half after 40 hours, for example. Whereas the non-exempt people do get those that coverage, so that we get time and a half after 40 hours per week. And so just various other pieces of information that might be useful. Pay range is quite often on this. Whatever. Okay, down below here is the job description, typically. Now, you're going to find these arranged in all different ways, but this is the way that's easiest for me to explain. So we have a job description. Job description is English sentences about the job, right? Not abbreviated, not a list, but just description of what this job is in a few sentences. Straightforward description of what the job entails. Underneath here, job specifications, which is what the incoming requirements in terms of skill that the applicant would have. High school education, college education, advanced degree, whatever it might happen to be, X number of years doing this type of work, et cetera. So whatever the specifications are, those are going to be the things that are required for people coming into the job before they even get the job. That's the job specifications. These are the two crucial documents that come out of the job analysis. The job analysis then yields, right, these two pieces of information, which of course would be useful from the point of view of hiring people. The description, specifications, and in here we're now going to see this major and minor responsibilities that I mentioned to you before, probably four or five, six of them in terms of major responsibilities. on the second sheet here, it's a bunch of information. We might have environmental issues associated with the job or working with particular chemicals. There's a lot of dust or noise on the job, et cetera. Here we have safety issues.
Does that first one say again?
Environmental. And safety issues, things that could hurt the job incumbent, the person who's doing the job, stuff, you know, dangerous wires, belts, knives, sharp things, et cetera, et cetera. And this might be a section here on what the future of the job looks like, what might be changing, that the company can keep in mind that there might be changes to the job that should be kept an eye on. So all this stuff, plus whatever else the company thinks might be worthwhile, to stick on the job analysis is incorporated in these few pages, and then therefore becomes so important from the point of view of getting the right person, how to train them, legal issues, et cetera, because these end up being associated with performance appraisal, also for hiring, whether or not the company illegally discriminated against women, for example, or race or whatever. They said, well, we never really considered women for this job, but, you know, it's just the way it is. We only hire men because you have to be able to, it says right in the job description here, that you need to be able to lift 100 pounds over your head. Right? Well, that's what the job description says. It better be that that's what the job does indeed require, because they're apparently selecting based on gender, based on the weight, which is, by the way, illegal at this point. You can't knock out, we'll talk about this in a minute, can't knock out an entire protected group under your suspicions that women can't lift 100 pounds.
But if you have less than 14 employees?
Actually, it's 15 or more. So under 14 at the federal level, state level, it can be less or more. You know, I have a paper on whether or not the intent of the state law mirrors the federal, to what degree that implies requirements for coverage. And a lot of that, in my opinion, if it's done correctly by the attorney, stuff that is taken to be 15 might use the state requirement of 2 just by the fact that it's in North Carolina, and the implication is that they should, or wherever it might happen to be, has a lower number. So in this particular case, I argued that this could spread to a wider application. So that a company said, well, we don't have 15 employees. Well, the state intent was that it would cover, you know, 2 or more employees. And so that was seen to hold in this particular federal case, interestingly enough.
What about, like, if you had somebody coming in and I can't think of anything other than maybe you have to lift boxes or something?
Well, what they're trying to get you to do is to actually try a person out. And as I usually say, because you might be illegally discriminating against the occasional Brunhilde, right, the weightlifter from Russia, who could easily handle this kind of weight. Or you might meet my wife, who can do a hell of a lot of push-ups with no problem at all, a hell of a lot more than I can do, with her legs up on the top of her Bosie ball, for God's sake. So you can't just say that women can't lift things, and it's assumed that you can discriminate.
Well,
so
no.
The job analysis helps to see that.
That's not what I'm trying to get at.
Okay.
I know that, like with the Americans with Disabilities Act, they have to make reasonable accommodations.
Correct.
If you turn around and say, okay, I can't lift 100 pounds, but I can lift 50 pounds, would that be a reasonable accommodation to where you lift the lighter boxes?
No, reasonable accommodation would mean that the person got one of those rolling dollies to pick things up, one of those hydraulic dollies.
Okay.
That'd be more along the line of reasonable, not the actual fact that they only had to pick up 50-pound packages, unless the EEOC came in and measured the weights of the packages and turned out they were only 50 pounds. Then the company's ass would be in a sling because they were discriminating based on 100 pounds giving tests, which was hurting women. whereas it really only required 50-pound lift. Okay, but if there's really a 100-pound lift, the reasonable accommodation would be one of those rolling hydraulic dollies with the long forks at the front. Whatever. All right, so what we're looking at here then is a document that's going to have a lot of impact across the things that the company does. A lot of legal considerations, and also, of course, the idea of making sure that you keep the applicant pool as large as possible, and we would use a valid selection process to find the right people regardless of protected group. We'll talk about that in a minute. Okay, so putting the job analysis in the foremost position of information toward getting new employees, we can begin to start thinking about then hiring. And what we're doing, as you know already, is making that transition time one to time two. And doing the transition, this transition here, by finding the right person, right place, and the right time. So this is now, then, and the goal over here, right? The right person, right place, the right time, and this would be HR trying to find the people to staff the jobs over here. We have the job analysis in place so we can understand our jobs here. Job analysis, our jobs. Job analysis for the future jobs. And can we have a reconciliation between these points here, our jobs versus future jobs? Can we make that adjustment? Can we take the two job analysis, look at them, and say, oh, well, we can just shift this and do that so that we can use our current employees? Or, no, we can't. We have to go ahead and buy them in the labor market outside the organization. But in the end, what's happening here is that the company is going to make choices about who gets these jobs out here. And those choices and how the choices are made are strongly defined by the various laws that are in place. And I need you to understand those laws. Without understanding those laws, you can, A, restrict the relevant labor market by only considering people that you illegally discriminatory thing can do the job, i.e. women can't do it, they're too frail, right? Or you could, you know, you're missing the applicant pool there, but you're also potentially running afoul of the laws, which could be a major lawsuit, not to mention a PR disaster. So what we're looking at here then is an important talk before I go on to the actual selection process of all the steps of selection. So I want to talk to you then about the legal considerations associated with hiring people and moving people around within an organization. The legal issues, if I had a sharp penknife with me now, I would encourage you all to pass the penknife around and perform a light trepanning job on the top of your head, which is when you cut a hole in your head, right? And use a spoon to take out the information that you think you know about this, the legal, and just, you know, bend them back and let go and watch the things that you think you know fly out the window because they're incorrect. So as much as possible, try to bring no understanding to this discussion because the things you understand are wrong. And so I need to straighten that out so that you do it correctly. How do I know they're wrong? Because I've never met anybody who hasn't taken my course that knows them correctly. That's a little bit of an exaggeration. There are other good professors too. But you need somewhere. So what you need to do is be sure to understand what I'm saying in the context of what's here. If you have concerns, things you say, well, what about such and such? It's okay to mention them. I don't have any problem. In fact, I'd rather have you mention them so I can show you where there's some and where something's wrong. Okay. So, to start off with, we know that most of this legislation came about in the 1960s, plus and minus a little bit, depending if you're talking about affirmative action. But in general, we're talking about the mid-60s. The mid-60s brought a tidal wave of change to what was considered legal hiring processes. Prior to that, in general, there was no federal law covering these kinds of considerations. There were various state laws. There were laws that involved, you know, working with children and this and that. But federal law in terms of protected group considerations were non-existent, basically. So what we have here is the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Civil Rights Act of 1964. Civil Rights Act of 1964 was a typical law addressing concerns of the citizenship about some problem, which is laws hopefully should address problems. And these laws were definitely addressing problems that exist. If you read novels from that period of time that might deal with L.A., for example, or if you lived in L.A., which my wife and I were doing, mooching off my parents as usual at the time, you could see the impact of racial discrimination at that point. The Watts riots were essentially burning in front of our eyes as we looked out the window of the house. I told you we sold Harrison Ford. Cool, huh? Anyway, out the glass window in front of the house, you could see Watts going up in flames. So that was an impactful moment for me to see a small part of L.A. going up in flames off the Harbor Freeway there. And so ultimately the Civil Rights Act was attempting to address concerns that a large percentage of the population was having trouble with. So I encourage you to read books from that time, see videos or whatever. I'm sure there are videos of all this going on too. So Civil Rights Act of 1964, I'm trying to figure out what to cut out, essentially says this. Corporate, and we know that means organizational, right? Corporate resources may not be allocated based on protected group status. So corporate resources may not be allocated based on protected group status. That's my summary of what this document says. The word discrimination does not appear in the document. What this is saying here is that as the company makes decisions about who gets what job, who gets a pay raise, who gets anything, essentially, because anything the company gives out is a resource, right, should not be based on protected group status. In other words, you're supposed to be basing it on other things besides a person's protected group status, which in the original document was this. Ready? Five things. Race, creed, color, national origin, gender. Race, creed, color, national origin, and gender were the protected groups initially written about in Title VII. Now, in parentheses after gender, put the word sex, S-E-X, because that's the way it's originally written. I've changed it to gender because, as you all know, all the other ones in there, race, creed, color, national origin, are nouns, whereas sex is a noun or a verb. I don't want this to be verbalized, put into verb form, which then becomes sexual harassment. It gets too confusing to talk about right at this point. So think of it as a noun, so I put the word gender in there instead of sex. Race, creed, color, national origin, and gender.
Race,
so
race and color could be verbs too.
It could be a race. If, you know, we're going to run around the track, or whatever it might happen to be. Color could be also because you're going to color in the page between the lines or something. Good point. Never thought of it that way. But gender is a good one that leaves there. Let me talk to you about what each one of these things means. Race, as you know, is white, African-American, Asian, Hispanic, whatever it might happen to be. Those are typical race delineators that have been used frequently in the past to allocate jobs or not allocate jobs, depending. Okay, creed, race creed. Creed is any form of religion or no form of religion. You can be an atheist, a druid, whatever it might happen to be. It's all going to fall under the concept of creed. Agnostic, whatever. That's all form of creed. Race, creed, color. Color is within race. Some people are darker or some people are lighter within race. I was confirming my belief that in China, because I have a Chinese student in my other class, that the all the minions that build all the things that are built in China by hand are built by people who are about 5 feet tall, short, and are extremely dark. Countryside farmers and peasants that come from the village. And I looked over at my Chinese student, she went, yep. Whereas the people who are in charge are all tall and fair, lighter skinned. And so within the, in that situation, if those people were in the States and Chinese person was discriminated against by color within race, then that would be illegal. Obviously within the African-American color scheme, so to speak, we have light and dark folks that could be treated differently based on the, their skin color within that category of race. Race, creed, color, national origin is your background, right? You came from Irish stock, Italian stock, German, Scottish, Asian, whatever it might happen to be. And you might be discriminated against years and years ago, particularly because you came from an Irish family and everybody knew that the Irish drank too much or whatever, right? People have these particular stereotypical beliefs about people and assume that it's passed down hereditarily. Well, you're Irish, you know. You're going to be not working. You're going to be drinking the whole time. It's absurd, but that's the stereotype that people had. And then finally, in the end, discriminating based on gender, right, male or female genders, is obviously illegal. It also presupposes that women can't do some things that men can do, which, of course, is a gross misconception. Yeah.
What about, like, Hooters?
Hooters is a discussion which I usually have at the beginning because I end up in such a fury and ranting at such a high level of intensity that the students all have to run out. I will boil it all down by saying that Hooters knows that they're illegally discriminating, but it's part of their business plan. They, in the end, say that they hire equally men and women, but the men work in the back and the women work in the front, which is called channeling, by the way. They channel the women to work in front and the men to work in the back. It's grossly illegal. Everything that they're doing is illegal. It's not a job-related BFOQ, bona fide occupational qualification. All a bunch of horse crap, and they get sued constantly, but they just use it for advertising. They don't care. My opinion is that the CEOs should be locked up for about 15 years and then see if they care. But, you know, what can I do? I always argue, don't want to get into this too much or I'll go off on a tear, that I'm opening a skinhead Nazi restaurant. Only Aryans need apply, right? Everybody carves a swastika in their forehead. Nobody that's a foreigner, nobody that isn't a tall Aryan white need apply. It's the theme of my restaurant. If they can do it at Hooters with lovely ladies, they can do it at my restaurant where we're all going to be a bunch of Aryan skinheads, right, that run the place. And if you don't like it, talk to Hooters first, right, and then come knocking at my door. If I open that restaurant, how long would it stay open?
30 minutes
max, right? And yet, Hooters goes on and on doing exactly the same thing. Customer preference, see, you've got me wound up. Customer preference is not an OT, is not a legal grounds for illegal discrimination. You may not discriminate based on protected group by what the customers want. Rudy Diaz applies back in the 1970 to be a flight attendant. Oh, no, you've got to be a beautiful and shapely woman to carry tea and coffee around in the airplane, right? Rudy's a little guy, right, wants to be a flight attendant. Judge said, nope, customer preference is not part of this. You're there to fly airplanes, not to present beautiful women to the businessmen that happen to be on the plane. It's a bunch of horse crap. So
can
that got thrown out. Huh?
Can I retract that question until Thursday?
Can you what?
Retract the question I asked until Thursday.
Sure.
Thank you.
I'll try and take the steam off of this discussion. Right, really pisses me off they get away with that crap. But they do. It's America for you. Just pay off the right politicians and it'll all work out. All right, so what we have here then, race, creed, color, national origin, and are the protected groups that were originally written up in Title VII. Again, note the word discrimination does not appear here. It's how you allocate things, resources that the company has, parking spots, jobs, pay increases, training, blah, blah. Doing that, of course, if you do it illegally, means, and we'll go through the whole legal process eventually here and over, this, the whole thing with the other laws takes around 5 class sessions, so it'll be a while. But doing it, you end up in court, and you end up, depending on the type of discrimination it is, whether it's direct or indirect discrimination, you end up with a substantial fine, typically. And quite often, there's punitive damages associated with intentional discrimination, which can be extremely expensive. Ask, I think it was Ashland Oil, that had to give up 50% of their profits for a year based on hiring older people versus not older people. Interesting. That was, I think that was settled at $50 million, something like that. All right, so all of this means that the law wants you to do the right thing. You should already do the right thing because you want the best people. And eliminating one of the protected groups because you're too dumb to realize that good people can be male, black, white, whatever it might happen to be, right, doesn't preclude you from having to follow the law. You have to follow the law, but it also helps the company by getting the best person and keeping your applicant pool as large as possible. Okay, so now, as we start into this discussion, we're going to be talking about, next time, what we're going to be talking about is known as adverse treatment. Adverse treatment, write this down, you can mull it over, is the idea of intentional one-to-one protected group, PG, right? Protected group, one-to-one intentional protected group discrimination. We'll have to define discrimination, which is defined quantitatively by numbers. But for the time being, just understand that adverse treatment or disparate, D-I-S-P-A-R-A-T-E, disparate treatment, same thing, is this idea of one-to-one intentional protected group discrimination. And it was the concept back in 1964. That's all that illegal discrimination was seen to be, this intentional one-to-one. I'm not hiring you because you're this, or I'm hiring you because you're that, right? Direct. It's now, the much larger part now is indirect, but we'll talk about that later. So this, just understand this idea of adverse treatment here, and how it relates. So this adverse treatment is just using these protected groups to determine who gets plus and who doesn't get. Minus the various resources the organization has to offer. Got it? Yes, Dr. Fox, we'll be studying this for our quiz on Thursday, which will be getting down to become more complicated as we move along in quizzes. All right, that's it for today.